All righty, welcome to a Friday edition of The Agenda. Last week, we took a look at the legislative session coming up with our state senator, Brad Hawkins. You know, we could have spent the whole time talking about education, and we were visiting off the air once we wrapped up last week with Senator Hawkins and Brad. We thought, you know, maybe we could come talk a little bit more about the priorities and the spending in education. And we'll touch on some more coming up. But thanks for coming back. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Dave. It's exciting. There's always been a lot of talk about education funding, school facilities, and so I really appreciate you dedicating the hour to kind of doing a deep dive on this issue. It's really important to me. It's important to a lot of people. So it's good to get into it with you.
So. You know, is it easy, is it an oversimplification to say, okay, well, we're having to spend so much more on education because of the McCleary decision. Is that fair to say? Or is that paint the whole picture?
Yeah, not really fair to say anymore. Good question. So the McCleary decision, for the KPQ listeners, just as a little refresher, was a state Supreme Court decision interpreting the constitutionality of the fact that education is stated in our state constitution as our paramount duty, and we have a duty to amply fund a K-12 education. Again, this is K-12 education, so there a lot of the school districts are now are sort of getting into pre-K services, but that was a big battle. That state Supreme Court decision was issued in 2012. It took the legislature a substantial amount of time to sort of settle that situation with the state Supreme Court. But at that time, I think it was about 4 years later, maybe six, but the state Supreme Court had determined that we were fully funding education. But since that time, and maybe that's why we're here, K-12 education spending has still significantly increased at the state level. It's also increased significantly at the local level through local voter-approved levies. And so it's just an interesting situation, yet school districts still come to me as a legislator almost every year and say, we need more funding, we need more funding, we have more needs, and these needs aren't getting met. So it's kind of created a whole conversation where I've had to step back as a legislator and say, well, what's happening in our education system? So just for example, Dave, in terms of school funding, back when the McCleary decision was first issued, and again, we had to increase funding at the state level to satisfy McCleary, but the education funding per student per year on average was about $8,700 per student. That was in state and local dollars.
This was 2012, 2013.
Yeah, and so now it's over $15,000 per student per year on average.
Almost doubled.
Some school districts are higher, some are less. School districts also, they receive a collection of dollars. You hear a lot about education funding being a state responsibility, and it is based on our constitution, but school districts receive local dollars through their levies that voters approve. They receive some federal dollars and also mostly state dollars based on their enrollment. Well, when you combine the local, state, and federal dollars, right now it's, or last, this last year is on average about $17,200 per student per year. So I have two kids right now in public schools, my sons Luke and Tyler. $17,200 for him, $17,200 for him. Yet the whole issue too is that the performance on average, not picking on any particular school district, but on average, meeting the standard, again, this is post-pandemic, there's lots of challenges there, but for English language arts, it's just about 50% statewide across grade levels. And for math, 39%. So we got some issues here. We got to figure out what's happening.
Well, so we're talking to State Senator Brad Hawkins. Last week we talked about the legislative session ahead and, you know, tried to touch on each of the three budgets. So we just want to kind of talk about education. We'll kind of focus on that for the hour. So it went from $8,742 per student a decade ago, 2012-2013, to 22-23, districts receiving approximately $15,462 for students, and then you add in some federal funding, it jumps that up to about $17,200 per student. And obviously, there's a whole lot of folks paying for kids in public school that are no longer in public school, certainly. But how much of this how much of that increase, that doubling in 10 years, is just McCleary? How much of that could you tell us is because of, well, schools need to do this now, schools need to do that now? What would you estimate that?
It's a little of everything. So the state did significantly fund education more due to McCleary. But at the same time, we actually, this is when Senate Republicans were in the majority, which now seems like a long time ago, but we capped the local levies. Because the whole issue with McCleary was that the state should be funding K-12 education, and that we had this expansion of local levies to supplement what the state arguably wasn't doing. So when the state stepped up and said, we're going to fund education significantly more, we wanted to cap local levies. And then when we lost control of the Senate, that cap was lifted. And that kind of gets into a whole political debate. But the local levies have significantly increased. A lot of the school districts will say, oh, this is a replacement levy. Well, sure, it may replace what's expiring, but you're also asking for an increase. And at one time, the local levies were a 60% threshold to get approved. And this was before I was elected to legislature. The legislature lowered it to a simple majority 50%. And that kind of gets into this whole debate, which maybe we can discuss in the second half hour about school bonds and what the thresholds should be. But it's been a mix. It's been a mix of increased state dollars and the school districts asking for more and more. So I kept trying to figure out, well, why is this happening? Why is this? We're sort of fully funding education. Now, in fairness, some of those cost figures you have to account for inflationary factors or population growth, but this is per student on average. And every school district's a little different. There's 295 school districts in the state. They're actually local government entities like cities and counties. They're overseen by their locally elected boards and administered by their selected superintendents. So they're kind of separate entities, but the state does fund largely based on enrollment, and that funding has increased. Just this last legislative session, which is a reason I voted against the operating budget, actually, the state increased funding for K-12 education by approximately $3 billion, but it was largely to fund the same system, just more generously. Not to try to use that $3 billion to make targeted intensive tutoring to bring kids to grade level post-COVID and all these different things. It's just every year, it seems like, Dave, and this is me, I'm a supporter of education. My wife's a teacher for Wenatchee School District. I have two kids in public school, as I mentioned. I'm a former school board member both for Eastmont and North Central Educational Service District. But it seems like we just keep spending more and more taxpayer dollars on education to kind of largely fund the same system, and the performance statewide, and maybe it's a whole argument about the testing and things like that, but we're funding it more and more, yet the results, the performance theoretically is not increasing. And so we have to think about the cost, the taxpayer funding as investments, and are we getting a return on that investment? And I argued in the recent Seattle Times editorial that we're actually broadening the services that school districts are providing. That's costing the system more and more, increasing the cost, but actually sort of relegating academics perhaps to less of a priority.
So if we, if you go and you want to complain to your local school board, we're not talking about any particular school board in particular, but if you want to go and complain to your local school board, a school board member often is in a position where they're saying, we don't really have any choice over this. This is what we are mandated to do in many cases. So folks could certainly go online and find your editorial that was published in the Seattle Times. I think the Wenatchee World also picked it up as well. you're on the education committee in LMP. You're, of course, Republicans are in the minority. But can't the legislature stop the superintendent of public instruction from saying, okay, schools have to do this, schools have to do that? Is there any balance of or check on those powers?
Well, it's interesting. So the superintendent of public instruction actually doesn't have as much authority as he thinks he has, just based on the Constitution. But a lot of school districts look to the OSPI, the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, as sort of the authority on guidance for this and that. But the reality is the legislature and state law that kind of controls some of what school districts do. But a lot of the school districts still have extensive amounts of local control, as they should. I mean, I support school districts having local control. As a former school board member, I think it's super important. One of the things, though, I've noticed as a troubling trend in recent years is that the state legislature has been sort of dictating certain policies for all school districts to adopt. Sort of, you shall do this and you must do this by a certain date. That sort of is an erosion of local control, sort of death by a thousand cuts on some of these school districts. But school districts still have significant local control, and some of the services that they provide outside of what the state funds, for example, are their control. And it's interesting. And so what I guess I was getting at a little bit in this opinion piece at the Seattle Times, which thankfully the Wenatchee World republished, is that school districts are sort of broadening the services that they provide somehow, I think, through OSPI and other statewide education officials. They've sort of succeeded in strategically and systematically redefining education to sort of mean everything. And it is a tough discussion because we have a lot of needs in our student population, but who meets those needs is kind of the bigger question.
So McCleary said that it's the state's primary duty to fully fund K through 12 education. In a moment or two, could you give us a simple explanation of what fully funded education is? And does that include all of the new things that schools seem to be doing?
No, it doesn't include those things. And so school districts, arguably, to do some of those things, and these are things that students need. I mean, it's just, that's not a question, but mental health counseling, full day of nutrition. Some school districts, I think many, provide year-round child care as a service, even in the summer when school's not in session. A lot of additional programs that, you know, some school districts, I think Wenatchee too, are co-locating healthcare services. And maybe that's a lot of the service providers like cover the cost of some of those. But arguably that is increasing the complexity of school districts. And what the state has is we have what's called a prototypical school funding model, where we fund a certain amount of services based on enrollment, and we kick out a formula of state funding per student. But the school districts are saying, well, that's not enough. So now we're using our local levy dollars to hire more staff to provide these services that we feel our school districts need. So it's almost setting up a McCleary-like situation all over again, which is, again, the expansion of local levies to make up what the state isn't funding. And a lot of the education advocates are coming back to the legislature saying, well, we need to update and modernize the prototypical school funding model to include all these additional services. And I guess that's really my question, Dave, and what I'm trying to put out there for a conversation statewide is, where does the responsibility of a school district end, and where does the responsibility of a family and community begin? And the more services that school districts take on, arguably, the less the community is willing to step forward and do. And so there's no dispute that there's a tremendous amount of needs in our student population, but whether those services to meet those needs should be provided by the school district or by a community wraparound social service provider or a community healthcare provider or other things? You know, that's really the question. Because if we're going to redefine education to kind of include everything, I will tell you, Dave, we will never, ever be able to fully fund education. We could take the entire state budget. Right now, about 44% goes to K-12 education. We can make 100% go to K-12 education, and it wouldn't be enough. So we need to try to figure out what is the role of school districts given all of the additional needs in society that exist.
Well, many people using your analogy, where does the responsibility of public education end and the responsibility of parents begin? That suggests that in the point of your commentary or editorial is that the schools are doing too many things that maybe parents should be responsible for, or another agency or some other organization could be doing. But some would argue if it's a parent's responsibility, why is public education even being asked to do that?
Absolutely. In fact, I would argue and put forward that's one of the reasons why many families have been pulling their students, their children, out of the public school system at high numbers. So it leads to a whole philosophical debate, parental rights, and all these things when school districts are trying to deliver all of society's services through their school buildings. Also, it creates some capital needs. I don't know where you could have the space. But to be fair, a lot of advocates, I mean, we all want what's best for kids. So a lot of people say, well, the kids, not all parents are active parents. They're all doing the right job. Well, that's where then assessments and referrals to community providers come in. But then some people say, well, we don't have the community providers and the kids have these needs. So therefore, the school district should provide the services. And that's really where I interject and say, well, this is a tough conversation, but just because a child has a need and that child is a student of a school district doesn't mean that meeting that need is a school district responsibility. And people will say whether, you know, it's all these difficult situations about mental health, nutrition, childcare, and all these other things. But we have a shortage of childcare providers. I would actually argue one of the reasons perhaps is that once the school districts step up to provide year-round childcare, I mean, other local providers are like, I can't compete with the school district. And again, it gets really costly. But some people will say, well, the students in our building, and so it's most efficient to just provide that service in the building. Well, if that's the case, I say, Dave, I know it sounds absurd, but I say, well, then we should hire school dentists. Because if a child has a cavity and the child can't get access or can't afford it and shouldn't have to leave school, well, then just have a school dentist and take care of it on site, and then we'll get back to the classroom. But to a lot of people, that seems absurd, but when you look at all the different services school districts are providing, you can begin to realize. And again, if everything is a priority, I would argue nothing's a priority. Or what happens is academics, which is once the fundamental responsibility of our school system, sort of arguably gets relegated to either a lesser responsibility or a shared responsibility within this much broader system. And unfortunately, kids are graduating without being ready for their college or careers. And they need to be prepared to enter a global economy and be contributing members of society. And it's a challenge when they're not ready.
Well, we need to take a break here in the conversation. Lots more ahead for the hour. We're talking about education, priorities, spending. What about building schools? I mean, our community is going to need more schools. We've had bonds fail where they always previously were very well historically supported here. So it's an important issue all across the state. Again, the state spending per pupil I'll leave you with this number.
17,200 when you include local, state, and federal dollars, and growing.
And a decade ago, it was $8,742 per student. I don't know if you have the federal on top of that, but just the state part alone has doubled in 10 years. Mm-hmm. All right, we're back with more after this on The Agenda. So we're talking about education funding right now in Washington State, how that has really escalated in the last 10 years, essentially doubling for all practical purposes. And schools are having to do so much more. Senator Brad Hawkins is here, and he had authored an editorial when Anchi World picked it up. It was in the Seattle Times recently as well. And so, you know, I've got a daughter in public education as well, and she's not actually in the classroom now, but she started out in the classroom just a few years ago. But I really feel for teachers that, you know, may feel overwhelmed, overburdened with all the things that they're being asked to deliver and probably want to, but you can only do so many things at once. So, before we kind of move on, we're going to talk on about funding construction of schools and things like that in the second half hour. What about the issue of people you alluded to? Maybe people deciding I'm gonna homeschool. I'm gonna take my kids out of the public education system. What about what do you call it? School choice or the dollars following the student? We see that in some states, but not here. Is there any discussion of that? And I don't suspect in this state that has much chance of passing anytime soon.
No, it doesn't. Unless something develops to a point where the citizens ultimately put forward an initiative and say, you know, we need this, because it is taxpayer dollars. It's going to fund each student, and you know, we need to get a return on the investment. And the parents that do choose private schools and other things, you know, I have to essentially pay twice, because they're paying into the system through their state dollars, their local levy dollars, but then also paying for private tuition. And I just wanted to reiterate, Dave, I am a supporter of our public school system. I love our public school system. I had an awesome education here, K through 12, Wenatchee School District. My kids, you know, been through Eastmont. I'm a former school board member at Eastmont. I mean, we have such hardworking people here, but they are being asked to do a lot. And it's not just here, it's statewide. And you kind of have to wonder, that's a combination of state mandates and public expectations, but also local school boards, you know, deciding to do things beyond what the state funds. And every decision is important. And ultimately, I really have tried through this editorial to just encourage a statewide conversation to kind of rethink where we are, realize what's happening, and then have a conversation about it. Maybe have a community conversation too, with the school districts, can meet with different service providers to lay out what they feel the needs of the students are, whether it's an education school district need that needs to be met or an additional supplemental need outside of the school system. But really have those conversations. I really think we need to redefine or sort of rethink what's the most efficient delivery system and how to prepare students academically so that we're preparing kids to be as successful as possible, and then also not overburdening the school staff as well.
So we're going to dive into this. We'll come back after a short break here in just a moment. But what does the Supreme Court direct when it comes to funding school construction and all that? Just whet our appetite a little bit.
Sure, sure.
We call it a teaser.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting because we talked about McCleary. That was all on the operational side in terms of school funding on for staff and operations. But then also, we had a recent state Supreme Court decision on school facilities, which was arguing that the state's paramount duty, again, sort of extends to school buildings. And currently, state and school districts share in the cost of their facilities. And the argument before the state Supreme Court was that the state would essentially pay for all school facilities statewide.
Hmm. All right, let's dive into that when we come back on The Agenda. State Senator Brad Hawkins here. And so we've been talking with Senator Brad Hawkins about You know, our education system, the spending per pupil is doubled basically in the last year. Senator Brad Hawkins, who points out he's an advocate of education, former school board member, parent of young kids that are in the system currently, and former North Central Educational Service District board member as well. And you're on the education committee in the Senate as well. But what about the priorities? What about the priorities? And by doing and providing all these services, soup to nuts almost, you could somewhat maybe phrase it that way, is that overburdening our education system and burning folks out, making people consider alternatives to public education? So we've been talking about that for the first half hour. Now let's talk a little bit about how our school facilities are funded. And you just mentioned that state Supreme Court ruling. We have to, right now, to pass a bond, we've got to go 60%, but our levies are 50% plus one vote.
Right. So just kind of set the table for everyone. School operations and school facilities are sort of funded a little bit differently. So what we're talking about that first half hour is all sort of for operations, state tax dollars, local levy dollars, some federal dollars. Well, when it comes to school facilities, those are subject to a shared responsibility between the local school districts and the state. But the local school districts have to get a bond approved at the local level at a 60% threshold to be eligible for state matching grants for their buildings.
Why 60%, not 50%?
Well, the local levies used to be 60% too, but like I said, before I was elected to legislature, it was reduced. I actually support the levies being 50%. Those are short-term taxes that are subject to being reauthorized. But the bonds are longer-term obligations that encumber residents and community for a decade or more, like sometimes 25 years. So to me, I think there should be a higher threshold for the bonds. And why it is 60% is currently our state constitution requires that. And so any change would need to change the state constitution. But to me, the school levy or school operations and school facilities are different, but it's confusing to people, Dave, because both involve the school districts and a local vote, but there's different thresholds because they fund different things. So the way I like to remember it or tell people is levies are for learning and bonds are for buildings. And if people kind of remember it that way, it helps. But we also have programs at the state level in addition to the matching grants for the school districts that approve their bonds at 60%. We do have different programs, grant programs in place, the Small School District Modernization Program and others to assist school districts if they don't get their bond approved. But I'll tell you what, Dave, a lot of school districts say that the only reason they can't pass their school bonds is because of this 60% threshold, but that's not actually the case all the time, because when I was a school board president at Eastmont, we actually passed a school bond at 60% on the November general election ballot during a recession. So we were successful in doing that. We renovated Eastmont High School, Sterling Middle School, in Grant Elementary. And you can do it if your communications are good and if your board is unified. But sometimes there's a lot of situations unrelated to the 60% threshold that can kind of jeopardize a bond measure. So for example, if a school district asks for too much or their communication's not on point, that somewhat was the case, I think, with Eastmont. They asked for a lot. It was kind of rushed, and voters were a little confused on some things, and they didn't support it. I think Eastmont got 51%. Now they said, hey, we heard you. We're going to refine it, and we're going to put it towards voters again. So school districts sometimes have to go through that a time or two before the community is ready to sort of literally buy in. Other times, the school districts have a divided school board or other issues between collective bargaining groups and things that are going on at the school district level, or a lot of transition with the superintendent. So if you think about a divided board or a lot of transition with a superintendent, well, that's somewhat like what Wenatchee's gone through. Again, I love our school districts, but there are different reasons why other than, I think some school districts saying the 60% threshold is the reason is a little too easy of a reason, you know?
I guess so, tying back to your original point as well, that if we can get the student performance up higher, do you believe that people would be more inclined to vote a levy or a bond?
I do. I think it's a combination of factors. Like I said, I think it's a successful superintendent, some continuity there, good school district communications, a unified board, a supportive staff, and sort of a harmonious situation, plus, you know, economic considerations. Right now, it's probably a tough time because of increased gas prices, inflationary factors, and other things. That's not to say Eastmont won't be successful in February when they run their bond. Maybe they will be. But also, you know, it's interesting. My experience on the school board is that a lot of the school districts, they usually had a really reputable person that sort of was overseeing their facilities and stuff. But then when it came to actually running the campaign for the bond measure, school districts are not allowed to campaign. I mean, they can send out informational things like newsletters and things, but they can't campaign. So there's sometimes very little to no actual campaigning. And when you think about the multi-millions of dollars that these school districts are undertaking, I almost think of it as like, you know, you should have a whole campaign arm separate than your
like a
school facilities.
Like a campaign committee.
Yeah. And
I mean, there's usually,
but it's like volunteers and parents and like, yeah, you know, everybody chips in $100. Like if I run a state Senate campaign, I need much more than a small amount of money. But it's just, I'm not here to advise school districts on what to do, but there's just a lot of factors that go into something like this. And I think a lot of school districts think, well, if we just do a good job communicating and share our informational handouts and flyers, then the public's gonna get the message. But you know, everybody's so busy too. It's tough to get your message out and really have your time with the voters so that they really have a clear understanding of what you're trying to accomplish. It's tough these days.
I'm looking at a chart here, Chelan County property taxes for 2023, and it's basically a pie chart. It looks to me like more than half of Chelan County property taxes would go to schools in some fashion or another. And some of this is just passed along, but more than half the pie is for schools.
Yeah.
And different in every county?
Slightly different, but I would say the bulk of people's property tax bill and everywhere it goes to schools. Now, some of that is the local levy portion. Some of that is the bond portion. So most school districts are paying back their bonds. Again, they're sometimes 20, 25-year bonds. So they're being paid back, you know, for many years. There is a small slice to the state for schools. That's the state portion of the property tax. But most of people's property tax bill is locally determined, either local levies, local school bonds, city, county property taxes, fire district, port district, regional library district, you name it. But I'll tell you, Dave, the one tax that I get the most questions about at my Senate office is the property tax. But the state portion is a really, you know, relatively small portion. Most of the property tax is locally determined, either by your elected officials or through public votes.
All right. We need to take a break here. More of the conversation on the agenda when we continue after this. Since you've been a school board member, can I we've only got a couple of minutes left here. That's turning into more and more of a thankless job.
Well, it was thankless when I served too, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
But I think it's more politically charged these days, and
sure.
There's all, you know, your whole premise about look at all these things that schools are being asked to do, and should they be doing them? They're not. It's not that kids don't need them, and these aren't services that kids need. Should the schools be providing them? And the fact that, well, it's convenient because they're there doesn't necessarily mean that's why the schools should be providing them. And the more plates you have spinning, like on the old Ed Sullivan show, is Are you old enough? Do you remember that?
I've seen clips.
Okay, you've seen clips. Thanks a lot. But if you're old enough to have seen the Ed Sullivan Show, there is that guy used to come out and he had all these tall sticks with plates spinning. He can run back and forth, and you're trying to keep them, and eventually the plates start to fall. So it seems like it's more. Would it be fair to say maybe to be more thankless, more difficult to serve on a school board? It's different in every community than maybe back in your day. And what is your advice for the role of school boards?
Yeah, you know, school board members do have a thankless job. It's a very complicated job that's, you know, little to no compensation. They might receive a stipend, some school districts, some don't. But they're tasked with, you know, overseeing multi-million dollar budgets. They have to know a little bit about collective bargaining, a little bit about education policy, a little bit about school finance. The school districts, at least the two in our Wenatchee Valley here, have a transit system that rivals Link Transit. And you think about the number of school buses and all of those operations too. So it, and then the capital needs and other things. This is very complicated. It's not getting any easier. So I really want to thank all the school board members who are stepping up to do that. But you know, one thing at Eastmont, when I served on the school board, is we had disagreements, but you know, I came on after a financial crisis and we managed to kind of get the school district turned around, but we valued everybody's differences, but we tried to support each other as best we could. So hopefully both the Wenatchee and the Eastmont school districts and other school districts on their board, even if you have disagreements, you know, you're able to kind of work together for the betterment of the students. But I will tell you, just because in some cases, like what you're saying, the state is mandating things, in other cases the school districts with their school boards are taking on more things. So yes, there's state mandates, yes, there's societal expectations, there's sympathy because there's a lack of services sort of being provided in the communities, but that's where I kind of go back to, I think school districts need to have this community conversation with all the different stakeholders, kind of a summit to talk about the needs of the students so that the needs of the students are being met, you know, whether it's kids' needs or academic needs.
But I leave you with just 90 seconds here. What is on the education front, anything big? This is a short 60-day session. Yep. Look forward to in the session ahead.
Short session. We have already approved the two-year budget for 2023 to 2025. We're probably making adjustments to that. The bigger, heavier lifting will probably be during the 2025 session. So this time a year from now, we'll be looking ahead at maybe making some adjustments to that funding formula and everything. But I think things will be so quick over there that in Olympia, we're going to be sort of in and out before we know it.
Okay. So again, folks that would like to get more information about education or any other legislative matters or forward a concern to you, how do they reach you?
Yeah, best way is through my website at senatorbradhawkins.org. Education is always a big discussion. It's because it's approximately half of the state spending, but we have a lot of other energy, natural resource, law and justice issues. If people have any questions about any of those things, there's a contact form on my website, senatorbradhawkins.org. Click that, fill it out, and we will work to get responses to you as quickly as possible. Sometimes we receive 200 emails a day during session, but we'll get back to you.
All righty. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me on, Dave.
You bet.